Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 39. This one is called The Vision of Ezekiel as Directed by Terrence Malick. And I'd like to start this podcast by reading the entire chapter of Ezekiel 1. Ezekiel chapter 1 reads, "In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the river Chebar, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to the priest Ezekiel, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and the hand of the Lord was on him there. As I looked, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the middle of the fire, something like gleaming amber. In the middle of it was something like four living creatures. This was their appearance. They were of human form. Each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands, and their four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each of them moved straight ahead without turning as they moved. As for the appearance of their faces, the four had the face of a human being, the face of a lion on the right side, the face of an ox on the left side, and the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies. Each moved straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they went without turning as they went. In the middle of the living creatures, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and lightning issued from the fire. The living creatures darted to and fro like a flash of lightning. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl, and the four had the same form, their construction being something like a wheel within a wheel. When they moved in any of the four directions without veering as they moved. Their rims were tall and awesome, for the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels moved beside them, and when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When they moved, the others moved. When they stopped, the others stopped. And when they rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was something like a dome, shining like a crystal, spread out above their heads. Under the dome, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another, and each of the creatures had two wings covering its body. When they moved, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of mighty waters, like the thunder of the Almighty, a sound of tumult like the sound of an army. When they stopped, they let down their wings, and there came a voice from above the dome over their heads. When they stopped, they let down their wings." And above the dome, over their heads, there was something like a throne, an appearance like sapphire, and seated above the likeness of a throne was something that seemed like a human form. Upward from what appeared like the loins, I saw something like gleaming amber, something that I looked like a fire enclosed all around, and downward from what looked like the loins, I saw something that looked like fire, and there was a splendor all around, like the bow in a cloud on a rainy day. Such was the appearance of the splendor all around. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of someone speaking." Now, the way that we react to this vision of Ezekiel is different based on the person who is hearing the vision. For instance, if you are a religious person, you know without a doubt that this vision, because it's in the Bible, occurred and was given to Ezekiel by God. Because of that, you feel your responsibility as a religious person is to figure out what this vision means. And so you ask questions. And you don't just ask a few questions, but you ask every question imaginable, because this vision, as mysterious as it is, has a purpose and a reason. It is in the Bible. So religious people hear about this vision and they immediately launch into a series of questions, something along the lines of this. What's with the four-faced creatures? Why do they have four heads? Why do they have the face of a human, a lion, an ox, an eagle? Why the number four? What do these creatures represent? And why has this vision been preserved for thousands of years for me to read today? Why are there burning coals? Why does lightning come out of the fire? Is this what God can do for us? Help us extract lightning from fire? What does the wheel represent? Why are the rims high and awesome? Why are there eyes in the rims, and what does that mean? What is the dome over everyone's head? Why do the creature's wings sound like an army? Is the voice above the dome the voice of God? Why doesn't God speak to us today with visions like Ezekiel's? Is God busy, or does God have something better to do? And so religious people read about this vision and instantly analyze it with questions, because there's this sense that they might miss out on what God is doing unless they understand this vision well. But if you are not a really religious person, then your questions are a lot fewer in number. In fact, I think you can limit your questions down to two. Was this actually God, or was Ezekiel on drugs? Because this vision, in not-so-religious people's minds, sounds a bit kooky, a bit made up. And even if it wasn't made up, then what on earth does it possibly have to do with us today? With all these questions, I would like to share with you as you listen to this podcast why Ezekiel chapter 1 is one of the most profound, provocative, and progressive chapters in all of the Bible, and how it has personally impacted my life today. So with that in mind, let's first talk about the person who wrote these words. He was a man named Ezekiel. And there are some things that are important for us to know about Ezekiel. Ezekiel was born and raised in Jerusalem. And also in Jerusalem was a building called the Temple. Now, the temple was viewed within Jewish theology as the center of creation. It was a symbol for the sanctity and stability of all creation. The center of the world was the building known as the temple. Not only that, but back in Ezekiel's day, if you were to ask any good religious person, where is God? They would point to the temple. Because in the innermost chamber, the chamber named the Holy of Holies, is where Jewish theology taught the name of God resided. And so the temple was a symbol that God was living among the tribe of Judah. So as you can imagine, it was a great honor to be considered one who could work on the temple grounds. Not only that, but there was one person who once a year got to enter the Holy of Holies, where the name of Yahweh resided, and ask for forgiveness on behalf of the entire nation of Judah in a celebration known as the Day of Atonement. Now here's where things get interesting, because Ezekiel was born in this culture, and he was born with the promise of becoming a Zadokite priest. Now, Zadokite priests were significant because only Zadokite priests could serve at the temple. Zadokite priests could approach the altar and go within the temple walls. And the high priest, the highest ranking religious official in Judah, was selected from the Zadokite priests. He was the cream of the crop, the best of the best, and he alone was chosen and selected to go in the presence of Yahweh once a year for a few moments and ask for forgiveness. So Ezekiel is one of these Zadokite priests, and he has an outside shot of becoming the chief religious official, the high priest of all of Judah. Now, something that's significant about Zadokite priests is that they trained and trained and trained to become a good priest all the way until the age of 30. They were not allowed to serve unsupervised until they reached their 30th birthday. Then they could work the altars. Then they could serve fully as a priest on behalf of the people of Judah. So with that in mind, we turn to Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1, and the very first words of Ezekiel's prophecy are these: in the 30th year. The first thing we read is that this Zadokite priest is 30 years old. It is almost as if he is pointing straight to the altar at the temple and telling people, you want to know where I should be? I should be there, serving at the altar before the temple. And so in Ezekiel 1:1, we read, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the river Chebar. So Ezekiel begins this book by saying, I should be at the altar of the temple, but I am among the first exiles on the banks of the River Chebar. Now, the River Chebar was a long ways from Jerusalem. In fact, the River Chebar was in a different nation entirely, the nation of Babylon. And so, in the early 6th century BCE, the nation of Babylon came in and leveled Judah, leveled Jerusalem, leveled the temple. They then dragged the survivors across the desert all the way over to Babylon and said, "You will now all live as Babylonian. You are no longer Jewish. You are now Babylonian, and you better act like it." And so Ezekiel's first words of his book are, "In the 30th year, in the 4th month, on the 5th day of the month, as I was among the exiles on the River Chebar," he is basically saying, "Look, I should be there at the altar of the temple of the Lord, but I am here in Babylon on the banks of the River Chebar." The very first verse of Ezekiel's book is basically saying, "My life hasn't really gone according to plan. What was promised to me will probably never come true." I think it's important for us as we study the book of Ezekiel to remember that Ezekiel's religion, God, and theology have all let him down. He is alone, and he doesn't know what to believe anymore. Because he was told that God would protect him and his people. And Ezekiel is now living in a world where God didn't protect him or his people. And so Ezekiel is on the banks of the River Chebar, where everything has fallen apart. And he says, in the 30th year, when I should be a priest at the temple, 4 months in, he is counting the days. Ezekiel says, "The heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God." And then Ezekiel has that vision with wheels within wheels and rims that are high and awesome and four-faced creatures. And while we can easily get caught up in the symbolism of everything, there is one major question that we have to ask. Where is this vision supposed to happen? Well, according to Ezekiel's theology, he is now standing in the presence of God when he receives this vision. So the truth is, this vision is not supposed to happen on the banks of the River Chebar, because there's this idea that God has a presence and a finite location, namely in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, where Ezekiel had a chance to go to if he was selected among the Zadokite priests to be the high priest. His whole understanding of God was that he might one day get to stand in the presence of God in the Holy of Holies. Well, Ezekiel was now living in a reality where the temple didn't exist anymore. And he's on the banks of the River Chebar, where everything has fallen apart, and all of a sudden the heavens are opened up and he is standing in the presence of God. Where is this vision supposed to happen? Well, in the temple. But where does it happen? On the banks of the River Chebar. In a profane world. In a world that is not holy enough, in a world where God is not supposed to be. The fact that Ezekiel is in the presence of God on the banks of the River Chebar is challenging everything that Ezekiel has been ever taught about who God is. He's now living in a reality he simply did not know was possible. And he doesn't know how to respond to it, because as this vision is happening and there's domes and there's fire and there's lightning and there's horses and there's angels' wings, the only response he has is in Ezekiel 1:28, when he says, "When I saw it, I fell on my face and I heard the voice of someone speaking." God then gives some prophecies in Ezekiel chapter 2 and halfway through Ezekiel chapter 3. And then God stops speaking and we read about Ezekiel's reaction to everything. He says, "I came to the exiles at Tel Abib who lived by the River Chebar, and I sat there among them stunned for 7 days. Of course Ezekiel did, because he realized that everything he knew about God was wrong. And he had a real choice to make here. He could either bury his head in the sand and insist that his religion was not wrong, that everything he was taught growing up was in fact right. And even if God himself showed up and he stood in the presence of God, he would say, well, God, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be in the temple. So if this vision's nice, but could you go back to the temple? Because I need my religion to work. Ezekiel could choose to bury his head in the sand and insist that his religion was right. Or Ezekiel could open himself up to a new reality that Ezekiel barely knows or understands. Now, the second option is interesting because it requires Ezekiel to hold his religion loosely enough that he could be wrong. We call this humility. And great religion requires humility because God is revealing new things about reality every day that God is alive. And so religious people can insist that their religion is right and with pride and with boastfulness and with certainty can stand up and say, oh, no, we know who God is. There's no deviating outside of what we've known for years and centuries and millennia. But the truly great religion holds it loose enough to say we can barely understand God, and every day we learn more about who God is. Great religion requires humility. Now, I love elderly people. But there are the difference between those elderly people that seem petty and the elderly people that seem wise, isn't there? And there are few things that compare to sitting in the presence of an elderly person who is wise. I think the biggest difference between pettiness and wisdom is a person's ability to hold their life and their knowledge with humility rather than burying their head in the sand. But being willing to admit that they are could be wrong. And when they can admit that they are wrong, then they grow and they grow and they learn and they learn. And then all of a sudden, all of that learning and growth turns into wisdom. That's something powerful. And that's where great religion leads people. Religion that leads to pettiness usually insists on being right. But religion that practices humility ultimately leads to wisdom. And so Ezekiel has this choice. Is his religion wrong? Or is there a reality out there that Ezekiel barely knows or understands? Ezekiel chooses to open himself up to a brand new reality that he can barely process. In other words, Ezekiel stands up after 7 days of silence, and tells the other exiles, these people who have gone through horrendous evils and have been dragged across the desert by foreign invaders, he stands up and says to them, God is in Babylon. This was a brand new revolutionary idea in Ezekiel's day. It's so revolutionary, in fact, that as you hear me say the words, God is in Babylon, you need to put all of those words into caps. You then need to add an exclamation mark. You then should bold it and then underline it, because this is an idea that was not thought of within our biblical tradition until Ezekiel's day. God is in Babylon. Let me show you why this is such a problem for the theology of the day. Because Babylon is the place where religion, God, and theology don't work anymore. Babylon is the place where everything falls apart. Babylon is the place where horrendous suffering occurs. Babylon is the place where things stop making sense. Babylon is the place where you've made a mess of things. Now, religion often offers the exact opposite of what Babylon is, namely certainty, namely control, namely predictability. Namely, everything will work out if you just have enough faith. And here's Ezekiel in Babylon saying, yeah, you know how we got leveled by the Babylonians? Well, God is with us here when everything fell apart. Now, which one sounds more like the reality that you live in? Babylon or the temple? Because Ezekiel is saying in the midst of Babylon that God is here. God is with us. Ezekiel is basically saying that in the midst of his darkest suffering, Ezekiel is closer to God than ever before. Now, if this sounds like a paradox to you, then all I can say to you is welcome. We love paradox here at the Paradox Podcast, hence the name, the Paradox Podcast. Now, if we take Ezekiel seriously, and this is so counterintuitive, it's hard to describe unless you've lived through it yourself, then we can apply this lesson to our lives today, because in the midst of your darkest suffering, you are in fact closer to God than you have ever been before. Now, I want to be very clear, this is not a justification for suffering, as much as it is a way of understanding the way this world and this God works. When things fall apart for you, you are actually closer to God than when things were all together. When you have the least amount of faith and the most uncertainty about who God is, then you are, in fact, more in the presence of God than you have ever been before. Now, that may be a bit hard to believe. And in order to understand what that means and the implications for what that is for us today, I'd like to talk about the vision with the wheels and the wings and the lightning and the fire. Now, when I read the vision of Ezekiel, the closest thing I can come up with for what it feels like today is a Terrence Malick movie. Has anyone else listening seen or experienced a Terrence Malick film? Because I watched one without understanding that I was about to watch a Terrence Malick film. The movie that I saw a few years ago was this movie called The Tree of Life, starring Brad Pitt and Sean Penn. And the movie begins with Brad Pitt being a very, very tough father in the 1950s. Now, he is so angry with his kids that they aren't performing up to his expectations that it eventually turns into child abuse. This disturbing scene is all of a sudden transported to the edge of the universe and a giant bang. After the giant bang or the big bang, all of a sudden there are stars exploding for what feels like about 10 minutes. And then we finally cut back to planet Earth. But this is a different Earth than when we left last time. Namely, there are dinosaurs roaming around the Earth and the dinosaurs fight one another. Then Terrence Malick cuts from the dinosaurs fighting one another to Sean Penn wandering around in the desert. And then all of a sudden we see a baby's foot and like stained glass. And just when things are getting really intense, all of a sudden it cuts to black and the words written and directed by Terrence Malick show up on the screen. Now, I remember watching this film a few years ago, and I fancy myself as a bit of an intellect. So I wanted to tell people that I got it, that I understood what this movie was about. But the truth is, I didn't. So I went to one of the greatest prophets on the planet, seeking wisdom and guidance. The prophet's name was Google.com. And I went there, and I remember just after this movie had finished, typing into the search bar, "What just happened?" There were no satisfactory results after that question. So then the next question I asked Google was, "What drugs does Terrence Malick use?" Not a whole lot of helpful answers there either. So then I typed into Google, "Terrence Malick explains The Tree of Life." And I was shocked to find that director Terrence Malick doesn't do any interviews for his movies. He refuses to do them. Not only that, but in his contract, the movie production companies cannot use an image of his face or any kind of image of his likeness in their promotion of the film. And so while you can't hear what Terrence Malick thinks about when he puts these movies together, you can read interviews with the different stars of his movies and how they experienced making movies like The Tree of Life. So I came across an interview with Brad Pitt, who talked about making The Tree of Life. He said it was a really interesting film experience. There were no generators. There were no noise. The kids in the movie had never read the script. They would pick out their clothes that day. We weren't going off a script. We were using it as a springboard, but it could go in any direction. Weren't using the script. The kids hadn't read the script. What on earth are we talking about? Has anyone here been on a film set? You don't just show up and kind of wing it. I mean, there's so much money at stake here. You've got to get like all of these shots in. You got to make sure you know what shots you're doing. Otherwise, you're going to waste an exorbitant amount of money. And Brad Pitt's like, "Yeah, we didn't do that this time. It's just kind of like, let's try this. Let's see what happens if we go this direction." Well, Terrence Malick has made two films since Tree of Life. One was called To the Wonder, and another was called Knight of Cups. And in To the Wonder, they started changing the way that they operated with that script. While Brad Pitt said, yeah, there was a script, but kind of use it as a springboard. In To the Wonder, Terrence Malick's like, let's try something completely different. Let's get rid of the script completely. Now, this may sound strange to you, but Rachel McAdams in an interview talked about what it was like to make To the Wonder. She said there wasn't any script to look at. Javier Bardem, who plays a priest in To the Wonder, just got finished filming a scene with a character named Marina. He then walks off scene. This is true. He walks off scene, goes straight to the camera behind the scenes and says, I don't know who Marina is in the movie because I don't have a script. The crew doesn't talk. Nobody tells me, not even the director. Natalie Portman, who was in the film The Knight of Cups, says making this movie was improvisational for the actors and the camera. Teresa Palmer, who was in Knight of Cups, said, I was asking everyone on set I could find, who am I? Do you know anything about my character? And all the crew would say was, we have no idea. Wes Bentley talked about making this film, and he talked about it in a way that was very interesting. He said, if you're watching this film, The Knight of Cups, you really have to stop the training of your brain from all the other movies you've watched before. Just shut it down and experience this beautiful world Terrence Malick creates. What Wes Bentley is getting at is that Terrence Malick's films are more about experience than plot points. Terrence Malick's films are more about images and sounds than continuity. Terrence Malick's films are more about wonder than knowledge. And the truth is, you can ruin a Terrence Malick film with analysis. If you are obsessed with explaining everything in a Terrence Malick film, you will end up frustrated because it's impossible. Which brings us back to Ezekiel's vision. What if Ezekiel's vision is supposed to be like a Terrence Malick film? What if we're supposed to experience it rather than explain it? What if we're supposed to live in this beautiful world that God has created rather than analyze it? What if we can ruin it if we're obsessed with answering our own questions? What if what Ezekiel is trying to tell you is that God is in Babylon? If people say, well, what does that look like? And Ezekiel launches into this elaborate explanation about wheels and rims that are high and awesome and wings and thunder and lightning and fire. And then at the end of it, he just looks at you and says, you kind of have to be there. You kind of have to experience it for yourself. Just know that anytime I try to use my finite human language, it's going to fall short of the infinite glory of God. And you just have to live in the glory of God living in Babylon. When we approach the metaphor, the vision that way, all of a sudden things look very different. And I think the best way to understand it is to hear more actors and actresses talk about their experience of what it's like to live in a Terrence Malick film. Because it's very similar to how we understand life with God living in Babylon in the midst of some very dark suffering. The actress Frida Pinto says that making a movie with Terrence Malick is a very different experience, and it requires you to let go of so much. Christian Bale, who was the star of Knight of Cups, says that he was some days called to the set and he'd arrive on set and they were already filming. So he'd just have to walk into the scene and figure it out. That sounds exactly like my high school experience. Like I'd just show up and people be moving one direction and I'd be like, oh yeah, I guess we're going over here. Some days, he said, I'd arrive on set and they were already filming. So I'd just have to walk into the scene and figure it out. Nicholas Gonda, who was a producer on the movie of To the Wonder, the movie without a script, once famously said, To the Wonder was not a story that was crafted, it was discovered. I mean, that feels like life, doesn't it? Where you try to set up goals and you try to set up plans, but ultimately you kind of have to improvise in a lot of spots and life ends up looking very different than what you originally planned in your 20s. But perhaps my favorite quote about making Terrence Malick films comes from the actress Olga Kurylenko. When she talked about what it was like to be an actress on set in the movie To the Wonder, she said, I kind of know what's happening, but I'm not sure. I'm doing something not knowing exactly where it leads. Maybe it's good because in life we don't know where we are going. So making this movie is very real. And then she says, when we work with him, we have a feeling that we don't know what we are doing. But actually, he knows exactly, perfectly what we are doing. Now, what's fascinating is that sounds like a testimonial. When we work with him, Jesus, we have a feeling that we don't know what we are doing. But actually, he, Jesus, knows exactly, perfectly what we are doing. And these films, regardless of what you think about Terrence Malick films, are very similar to real life, where people just show up and do the best they can, and it ends up being something different than they anticipated. But man, the world that is created is one that is beautiful. I tell you all of this because when you consider the weight of God living in Babylon, in the midst of our darkest suffering, where everything falls apart, we have to believe in the omnipresence of God, that God is everywhere. And once we believe in that, as Ezekiel testifies to, we come to a shocking revelation. This world is filled with the glory of God. This world, with all of its heartaches, sufferings, trials, and uncertainties, this world is filled with the glory of God. Pause for a moment and understand the significance of this chapter. This world with death is filled with the glory of God. Your life, despite its hardships, is filled with the glory of God. The pain that you feel is ultimately part of a life filled with the glory of God. And the problem is, we can take it for granted and completely miss the presence of Yahweh. A few months ago, my wife and I were cleaning out my daughter's room. And as we were cleaning out her room, we came across several of her clothes. And as we started to put the clothes back in the dresser, we realized that the clothes were too small for our daughter. Now, these clothes were significant. I mean, we had held our daughter in our arms in these clothes, but they were too small for her now. And so we slowly moved these clothes, these tiny clothes, from the dresser to the donations pile. Now, what do you think happened to my wife and I? We began to cry. And we were just like kind of crying. I mean, we were sobbing, like, you know, the runny nose, the sniffles. I mean, it was just pathetic. But the question becomes, why were we crying? I mean, were we sad that our daughter had grown healthfully and had grown up? No, of course not. But we were sad because there was this wonderful phase of our lives where Maya, our daughter, was a tiny baby. And that phase, as much as it was wonderful and as much as it was filled with the glory of God, was in fact over. And it was temporary. Now, I could be angry with God and say, why do you allow her to grow? Why can't this moment last forever? Or I could look back toward myself and say, every day is precious because no matter how much I try, today will never be replicated again. And so if we were to look at tucking my daughter in at night, yes, it seems like an ordinary, mundane task. But the truth is, that ordinary, mundane task won't last forever. There's a finite supply of nights that I will tuck my daughter in at night. And so when I believe that the world is filled, this world is filled with the glory of God, all of a sudden, I can realize that those moments where I tuck her in at night, are actually laced with the presence of God. I can be more present. I can say this is the most valuable thing on the planet because I know it won't last forever. When my daughter is a baby and I can hold her, I know that those moments won't last forever. So I'm present. I savor those moments because I believe that this planet and this world is filled with the glory of God, and it is found in the mundane ordinariness of life that we find the extraordinary, transcendent vision of God that Ezekiel attested to thousands of years ago. May you, my brothers and sisters, open yourselves up with humility to the reality of God who is living in this world, and how this world is filled with the glory of God. May you recognize that when you are in the midst of your darkest suffering, that you are closer to God than you have ever been before. Grace and peace to you, my brothers and my sisters.